time to read the Des Moines Register for Friday, March 29th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Dave Buzik. My partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Barb Martin. For this first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. Then we'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather. The warmest temperatures of the week arrived this afternoon with 60s to near 70 for much of the area. A few showers and thunderstorms developed this evening, mainly across southern and eastern Iowa. Saturday will be cooler but dry. By Sunday, a large system will push across central U.S., bringing widespread chances for showers and thunderstorms that will continue through Monday, finally tapering off by Tuesday. Here is the day part forecast. Today, mostly cloudy and breezy, a stray shower or thunderstorm possible this evening, high of 69 today, winds out of the south around 15 miles an hour, gusting to 25. Tonight, isolated thunderstorms in the evening, mostly east of I-35, partly to mostly cloudy overnight with a low around 40 and winds out of the northwest at 10 to 15. Saturday, mostly sunny to partly cloudy, high 57, winds north-northwest at 10 to 15. Saturday night, partly cloudy skies early with more clouds overnight and a low of 41. Then for Easter Sunday, mostly cloudy with showers developing in the afternoon, thunders possible, a high near 55, winds out of the east-northeast at 10 to 20 miles an hour. And you know what that means. Sunday night, scattered showers and thunderstorms likely, low down around 43 degrees. Then looking ahead to Monday, thunderstorms in the morning, then cloudy with rain showers persisting, breezy conditions, high 53, winds out of the north-northwest at 15 to 20 miles an hour. So kind of typical March weather. And Barb, we're in the midst of March Madness. We've got the Iowa women playing tomorrow. And then kind of a disappointing result for the Iowa State men last night, losing 72-69 against a very good Illinois team. But it just seems like Iowa State missed a few open shots and the game could have been there. So let's go ahead and take a look at that front page of today's Des Moines Register.
Yes, Iowa women's basketball is a program of hugs, smiles, and wins by Chad Lystikow. Albany, New York, with a 23-point lead and just over a minute to go in Iowa's first-round NCAA tournament game against Holy Cross, Sharon Goodman was double-teamed after receiving a pass near the basket. Whatever happened next would be inconsequential to the Hawkeyes advancing into the second round. But the 14,000-plus fans still in their seats and the Iowa players and coaches on the nearby sideline cared deeply because they know Goodman's story. The players and coaches know her heart, and the fans feel like they do. They do, too. So she's an Iowa women's basketball player. So she's become family. Imagine if you had a sibling or son or daughter or any close relative playing in the NCAA tournament. Well, you'd be watching every second on the edge of your seat, too, no matter the score. That's how most of us are and were wired. To feel support from our loved ones and also to give support to those that we love gives us comfort and joy. To share moments of success together, well, that's part of what you're hearing when all those fans erupt when the ball goes through the hoop. And that's all by design, all part of the plan. A focus on relationships has been at the core of Lisa Bluter's 24-year tenure as the Hawkeyes head coach. We love each other. It's genuine, said sophomore Jada Jimfa. Who has scored 25 points this season, 1,888 fewer than superstar guard Caitlin Clark, but unofficially leads the team in hugs and smiles. Well, even if I don't get in the game, it's the care and joy when I see my best friends are being successful on the court. And I feel like a lot of the girls feel the same way. It's been written before, but worth repeating. When Bluter and her staff scout top high school players, they're watching how they react when they are not playing, not in the spotlight. Do they support their teammates from the bench? Do they have a love for the game and those around them? There was a lot of outside disappointment when Bluder and her coaching staff didn't add someone from the transfer portal last summer to a team that had a chance to compete for a national championship. But if they don't find the right fit personally as well as on the basketball floor, there is no path forward. Criticize that approach if you will. But Iowa heads to Saturday's Sweet 16 NCAA tournament game against Colorado at MVP Arena with a 31-4 record and a chance to snap a program record 32nd victory. The Hawkeyes are the number one seed in the Albany 2 regional, two wins away from the Final Four in Cleveland and four from the first national championship. In the view of Iowa coaches, bringing the fun to basketball not only brings out their best play, but helps develop them as women. They find the value in building healthy relationships, and they see the success that can come from being selfless and lifting up one another. Well, they're 18 to 22-year-old kids that started playing the game that they love. Longtime Bluder lieutenant and Iowa associate head coach Jan Jensen said, "And so many get it to this level, and they hate it. Well, they're stressed all the time, and it's awful when they lose a kind of good when they win. We wanted to be the ones that kind of made it still feel like the game that they fell in love with. Well, don't worry. We haven't forgotten about what happened about after Goodman caught the ball against Holy Cross. But first, let's rewind to two Saturdays earlier in the Big Ten tournament semifinals, to a sequence that became loved and widely shared on social media. You've probably seen it. Jensen came on our Hawk Central radio show recently, and she discussed it in depth. A dizzying display of seven passes by four Iowa players in less than 10 seconds that resulted in an exclamation mark three-pointer by Gabby Marshall to finish off Michigan. Kate Martin delivered the second pass of that sequence between a Michigan player's legs to A.J. Ediger, drawing a collective ooh and anticipation from the 18,000 or so Hawkeyes fans who poured into the Target Center in Minneapolis. Three times the ball made its way to Ediger in the post, and all three times she passed it to an open teammate, the last being Marshall, unguarded at the top of the key. Release, high arch, swish. The passing was fun to watch, no doubt, but the reason that clip became so intoxicating was because of the faces of the joyous Hawkeye players celebrating the moment as they ran to the other end of the floor to play defense. Kylie Feuerbach, who flicked the pass before Ediger's assist, was beaming. Ediger, a seldom-used center, gave the backpedaling Marshall a point of the high of the right finger and a big smile. I've watched that a few times just because you're seeing people in there that don't get a ton of minutes, Marshall said. AJ was the one that passed me the ball, and I was just happy for her. I don't get a chance to play with those players all the time. Let's let David help us out here. We both want to read about this. Dave?
Thanks, Barb. And it's a pretty long story. The biggest reaction from that three-pointer was from Kate Martin, the sixth-year senior. Arms out wide, like she was a human airplane, Martin laughed and let out a joyous scream. She said, "It's just like fun. I get more excited when my teammates do good things than when I do good things. I feel like a proud mom. I don't know. That's just how I feel." So how does that true family bond get created when players arrive at different times and typically stay no more than 4 years? Recruiting high-character people is part of it. Having the same coaches in place for more than two decades helps create that culture. But it takes work, too, and buy-in throughout the locker room. It's extremely rare that anyone transfers out of the program. Kate Martin said, "I just think that's something that Coach Bluder has always instilled in her players. She's not going to beg for effort and attitude. Coaches shouldn't have to beg for that. That's team-led, and that's just personal drive." Lisa Bluder has her team meet in a circle almost every day. In a circle, everyone can see each other. A circle doesn't have a front and a back. Everyone in the circle, even a celebrity like Clark, holds equal value. The circle is a safe place where coaching wisdom and personal feelings are shared. For example, in the hours before Clark broke the NCAA Division I scoring record on February 15th, Bluder had each player say something they loved about Clark as a person, not as a basketball player. Yefami said, "We definitely have gotten super vulnerable with each other within that circle and meetings and whatnot. I think that's something that builds that bond, the fact that we know that we can trust each other to pretty much tell each other anything. We know everything about each other." She said, "That makes you see each other from a different perspective. That, again, builds that care and love for each other." The crowds have followed this Iowa women's basketball team both physically and on TV. Home and away, Iowa played all but two games, both of those in a holiday tournament at Florida Gulf Coast, in front of raucous, sold-out crowds. On the road, fans would start lining up as many as 8 hours before tip-off to get their crack at a good general admission seat. Meanwhile, Iowa's first-round NCAA game against Holy Cross registered 3.2 million viewers on ABC, the most for a pre-Final Four women's tournament game. The previous record was 2.5 million for Iowa's Elite Eight win over Louisville last year. 2 days later, Iowa's 64-54 win against West Virginia shattered that record with 4.9 million viewers on ESPN. Is that the Caitlin Clark effect? Of course, the most famous player in college basketball is a big part of stoking that interest. But she knows more than anyone that the fan support is not all about her. She sees it firsthand. Look in the arenas and you'll see much more than just number 22 jerseys. T-shirts repping Hannah Stuckey or Kate Martin or Molly Davis or Gabby Marshall or Sydney Afalter are everywhere. As an example, the amount of web traffic that Davis's knee injury against Ohio State generated dwarfed that of an Iowa football game on a Saturday. People really do care about all these women, not just the superstar. Caitlin Clark said, "It's not like this everywhere. I know a lot of people say that, but it's simply not. People are valued. People have fun. People smile. Our bench might have the most fun out of anybody." Sharon was saying that she was going to throw up against West Virginia on the bench because she was so nervous. "I don't know if there's people that care more than them. I think it's the personality of our team. I think it's the smiles. I think it's the competitive fire. I think it's everything but the basketball, honestly. I truly believe that," Clark said. Another thing that the Iowa team does after every home game is gather at the center of the court and wave to thank the fans. There's an authentic mutual bond that has always been there with this program, and we started to really see it grow during the era of National Player of the Year Megan Gustafson, who led Iowa to an Elite Eight in 2019. Gustafson passed the torch to the affable and energetic Kathleen Doyle, who became the 2020 Big Ten Player of the Year. Then came Clark. And after a year of empty arenas during the COVID-19 pandemic, people swarmed by the thousands to soak in this enjoyable Hawkeye team. Clark said, "I think Hawkeye fans can feel that we truly appreciate them and we truly need them. Sure, we've made a lot of baskets, we've won a lot of games, but we've had a lot of fun doing it. We're competitive, we get the crowd into it, we smile, we high-five." Sharon Goodman is the epitome of a player who doesn't need to be a star to be beloved. She came to Iowa amid heart-wrenching circumstances, losing her mother to cancer when she was a high school senior. In December, Goodman and her family and coaches opened up to the Register about how difficult that was for her personally. "Getting through practice without tears was rare," Jan Jensen said. "Teammates were there for Goodman. The basketball never came first in those relationships, forged in a COVID bubble." And Goodman has always been grateful for that love and reciprocated it. She said, "It's genuine care that we have for each other. For me personally, that comes from my faith, not only wanting something to bring glory to the Lord, but also to build up others around me. That's a call I feel that I have, to bring joy and cheer on my teammates and cheer on their successes." So back to the final minutes against Holy Cross. As Goodman made a strong catch amid a crowd, a whole bunch of thoughts and emotions were figuratively contained in the basketball she gripped. Her mom's memory. 4 years of being a loving teammate. 4 years of perfectionist work that it's taken to assemble a 4.0 GPA and be on the floor for an NCAA tournament. 4 years of smiles from the bench when she wasn't playing, even though she longed to be. losing her starting role as a senior, but never complaining, even though it was difficult to once again watch from the sideline. And now, in this blowout situation, everyone in the arena knew that this could be the last time she touched the ball in a college game. Goodman plans to attend nursing school after the spring semester. She caught the ball and spun to her left between the two defenders. With her left hand, she floated a hook shot that hit the right side of the rim and rolled slowly toward the glass. The official's whistle blew a foul. Everyone on the court stopped. Everyone on the bench stared. Everyone in the stands waited. The ball trickled forward along the back iron and fell through the net. Goodman bent over to the ground, hands on her knees, then launched herself up with a giant smile on her face as if to say, "Thank you, God, for all of this." From the bench, Clark stood and clapped. Ettinger threw her towel to the ground in celebration. Sophomore Taylor McCabe shouted with joy as she approached her teammate. The crowd responded with one of the biggest roars of a loud game. Pure, genuine joy. Safe to say, a lot of eyes were welling up with tears for those who fully understood the moment. That is Hawkeye Women's Basketball 2024, so much bigger than one generational superstar. Coach Jensen said, "You realize that there's a lot more than seeds and rings and net rankings. It's what you're building and how you're building it and what they're learning. I think we've tried to coach that. We also try to live that. It's fun to go to practice, most of the days, right? That's what we should do in life. Find a job you love, and you'll never work a day in your life. It's a game."
Okay, now we need to turn to agriculture. Not just alcohol to blame for Iowa cancer crisis, huh? And this is by Keith Schneider. Amid increasing scrutiny of a potential link between Iowa farm chemicals and cancer, a new report is generating controversy as it blames rising cancer rates not on the toxins used widely throughout the state, but on something else entirely, binge alcohol consumption. The Iowa Cancer Registry, a health research group housed at the University of Iowa, reported on February 20 that Iowa has the second highest and fastest rising incidence of cancer among all states. An estimated 21,000 new cancer cases are expected to develop this year, and 6,100 Iowans will die from cancer, Iowa Cancer Registry Directory Mary Charlton said in announcing the new report. Iowa, she said, has the highest rate of binge drinking in the Midwest, with 22% of residents reporting binge drinking, more than the national average of 17%. Overall, Iowa has the fourth highest incidence of alcohol-related cancers in the U.S., according to this report. Alcohol is a known carcinogen and a risk factor for several cancers, including oral cavity, pharynx, larynx, esophagus, rectum, liver, and female breast cancers, Charlton said in a news conference. The assessment has drawn questions and sparked doubts, however, from the state leaders and health and environment researchers who have been calling for a probe into just how much the state's agriculture industry may be contributing to the spread of disease. Is alcohol responsible for the increase in cancer incidence here since 2014? I personally doubt that, said James Merchant, a retired professor of occupational and environmental health and former dean of the University of Iowa College of Public Health. What needs to be looked at are things that are probable and possible carcinogens that have increased beginning about 1990 because of the well-recognized latency of environmental cancers, Merchant said. And those carcinogens associated with industrial agriculture are the ones that really need to be looked at very closely. Iowa is the leading U.S. corn-growing state and is second in soybean production, with millions of acres devoted to the crops. Corn and soybean farmers typically make heavy use of pesticides and fertilizers on their fields. Iowa farms use more weed killers, like 237 million pounds, and apply more commercial fertilizers, 11.6 billion pounds, every year, more than any other state, according to the state and federal data. The chemicals are known to contaminate both soil and water and leave pesticide residue in the harvested grains. Researchers have long suspected that exposure to a number of the most popular pesticides, particularly the glyphosate, the active ingredient in the Roundup brand of herbicide, may cause human cancers. In 2015, the International Agency for Research on Cancer classified glyphosate as the probable carcinogenic to humans. Other studies have found that exposure to other common pesticides are associated with high cases of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, leukemia, brain, and prostate cancer. Iowa's sprawling livestock and poultry sector is also a concern. The Iowa operations produce more animal manure, 54.5 million tons every year, than any other state, according to federal and state data. Since 1992, for instance, the state's hog population has grown to 24 million. That's up more than 70%. Iowa's manure production in total has raised almost 80% since 2002, according to the latest U.S. Census of Agriculture. The manure from the animals contributes to the creation of nitrates, which form when nitrogen from the fertilizer and manure combine with oxygen. The waste streams routinely drain from farm fields into groundwater, streams, and rivers, contaminating water sources. Babies can suffer severe health problems when consuming nitrates in water, in drinking water, and a growing body of literature indicates potential associations that include an increased risk of cancer. And exposure to elevated levels of nitrates in drinking water from commercial fertilizer and manure has been linked by numerous researchers to cancers of the blood, brain, breast, bladder, and ovaries. David Quirtney, professor of civil environmental engineering and director of the Center for Health Effects of Environmental Contamination at the University of Iowa, recently started working with the Cancer Registry to explore potential environmental factors contributing to Iowa's cancer rates. He noted that multiple risk factors could be contributing to the problem in Iowa, including the nitrate exposure. Research studies show that's especially the case with colorectal cancer, ranked 8th in incidence among all states, and breast cancer, ranked 9th. We're unique in terms of our production systems here, unrivaled anywhere in the world, right? Says Swirty. That's C-W-I-E-R-T-N-Y. We're proud to boast about that, but we shouldn't be so foolish as to think that the unrivaled scale of production doesn't come with very unique consequences or challenges for our state, right? The new registry findings focused on alcohol consumption are not agricultural chemicals, come as public interest in cancer has swelled across the Corn Belt. Legislation to invest more state funds in research that identifies environmental sources of cancer has been introduced in Iowa as well as Nebraska. In Minnesota, legislators are proposing to introduce a sales tax on commercial fertilizer to pay for closing drinking wells contaminated with nitrates and supplying thousands of southeast Minnesotans with the clean sources of water. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency ordered Minnesota to halt nitrate contamination in groundwater last November. Alcohol consumption is a known risk factor for certain cancers. Nearly 4% of cancers diagnosed worldwide in 2020 can be attributed to alcohol consumption, according to the World Health Organization. In the United States alone, about 75,000 cancer cases and 19,000 cancer deaths are estimated to be linked to alcohol each year. Alcoholic drinks contain ethanol, which is a known carcinogen, according to the National Cancer Institute. And yet, linking alcohol to rising cancer rates in Iowa seems questionable, given some of the data points. Iowa's per capita consumption of alcohol ranks 24th in the nation, according to Statista and Data Research Service. Drinking habits in Iowa do not appear to have changed dramatically in the past few decades, though about a fifth of those who drink alcohol in Iowa identify as binge drinkers. 5 drinks at a sitting for men and 4 for women. Even so, Iowa's binge drinkers don't appear to be drinking more heavily now than years ago. On average, Iowa's binge drinkers consumed 586 drinks a year in 2017, the latest year for data, 6 more than in 2011. Iowa was one of the 39 states where binge drinking did not change significantly during that period, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Nationally, rates of alcohol consumption and cancer have diverged. Per capita consumption of alcohol in the U.S. increased to 2.51 gallons annually in 2021, 17% more than in 1999, according to federal figures. But the national rate of cancer incidence declined 16% during that period, according to the CDC. Iowa's increase in cancer incidence appears to have started around 2012, according to the CDC and the Iowa Cancer Registry. That rise in incidence occurred about 20 years, the scientifically accepted cancer latency period, after the start of Iowa's rapid industrialization in farming. Having a high cancer rate doesn't immediately translate to its being caused by industrial agriculture, although I think there is just a strong reason to look very hard at that direction, in that direction, said Merchant. Public confirmation last year of Iowa's high cancer incidence also converged with what most adult Iowans already knew in private. Cancer is everywhere in Iowa. Among the 25 counties in the U.S. with the highest incidence of cancer, Iowa's Palo Alto County ranks second. Roughly 21,000 Iowans now develop cancer in Iowa annually, according to the Iowa Cancer Registry. That's more than twice as many cancers as occurred in 1973 in the state, where the current population, 3.2 million, is a mere 11% larger than it was 50 years ago. Democrats in the state Senate and House proposed legislation this year to increase funding for health studies aimed at definitively identifying the sources of malignancies. We need to make this statement given the rising cancer rates here and our number 2 rate in the country, said State Senator Janice Weiner of Iowa City, who proposed a bill in January to invest $5.25 million for research on pediatric and other cancers to stem that, what she called, Iowa's cancer crisis. I have colleagues on the House side who have filed similar legislation that has bipartisan support, she said, so I'm hoping it will move forward. We have a serious problem in Iowa. We owe it to Iowans not to whitewash anything, but to approach it scientifically and get to the bottom of this, wherever research and clinical tests lead us. Charlton did not respond to an interview request for this article.
And Barb, we have a just developing story that we've just learned about. Louis Gossett Jr., the first black man to win an Oscar for supporting actor, has died at the age of 87. Gossett Jr.'s nephew told the Associated Press that the Emmy Award-winning actor died Thursday in Santa Monica. In 1982, Lou Gossett starred as Marine Gunnery Sergeant Emil Foley in An Officer and a Gentleman, for which he scored an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor and became the first black man to win in that category. The Brooklyn-born Lou Gossett, who attended New York University, became one of the most famous black actors with decades of commercial and critical acclaim. In addition to his groundbreaking Oscar win, the pioneering talent won an Emmy for his role in the TV miniseries Roots, based on Alex Haley's book of the same name. Throughout his life, the actor publicly battled a slew of health struggles. In 2010, Gossett announced his prostate cancer diagnosis, and a decade later, in December of 2020, Gossett was hospitalized with COVID-19. Again, Lou Gossett Jr., dead at the age of 87. Returning to the front page of today's Des Moines Register, Bill says issues of eminent domain can go to court. The measure gives option to landowners and companies. This story by Galen Bacarrier. The Iowa House on Thursday approved legislation that would allow landowners and companies involved in eminent domain proceedings to go to court and seek a constitutional review of the process. Under the bill, House File 2664, which passed on a vote of 86-7, a landowner or a company who is facing the Iowa Utilities Board would be able to request review from a judge in Polk County. And if more than a year and a half passes after court action begins in Polk County, a person can seek review from a judge in another county. The bill's passage comes as Summit Carbon Solutions continues through the regulatory process in a bid to build a carbon capture pipeline across Iowa. Representative Charlie Thompson, a Republican from Charles City, the bill's sponsor, said it would provide landowners affected by the project with more immediate answers about the future of their properties. Thompson said, "It was never the intention, as far as I can tell, of the creators of the Iowa Utilities Board to have a process that, in effect, takes land from people without due process. I don't think Iowans would have sanctioned such an idea." Summit did not immediately respond to a request for comment on the bill's passage Thursday. The legislation is Iowa lawmakers' latest attempt to address eminent domain, particularly as it pertains to construction of the pipeline. Republicans who control both chambers of the legislature have split on this issue. Proponents of the pipelines argue that they are critical for Iowa's key ethanol industry to remain viable long term. Opponents, though, criticize the use of eminent domain to build the projects and raise concerns about their safety. Multiple companies led by the Ames-based Summit are seeking to build the $8 billion, that's $8 billion with a B, dollar pipeline across Iowa and neighboring states. Another proposed $3.5 billion pipeline project from Navigator CO2 Ventures died last year after the company encountered regulatory hurdles. Representative Thompson suggested that Summit and other companies shouldn't take issue with the legislation, arguing that it would be better to have the issue of constitutionality answered at the beginning rather than having to wait until the very end. And Representative Bobby Kaufman, a Republican from Wilton, delivered a frank message on the floor for those, quote, who would attempt to use their money to influence or prevent the Thursday vote. Kaufman said, "My message is, take your money and shove it." The legislation now heads to the Senate. Senator Dan Dawson, a Republican from Council Bluffs, said on PBS's Iowa Press last week that he wanted to see the final product, but remarked that it was a unique way to address concerns with eminent domain that was a priority for some people in the Senate. Senator Dawson said, "How we deal with some of these out-of-state regulations that are getting heaved upon us makes things complicated. But I think it's definitely something to take a look at." A bill passed the House last year that would have required companies seeking to build pipelines to reach voluntary agreements to buy 90% of the land on their proposed route before petitioning the state for eminent domain. That bill last year died in the Senate. A previous version of the bill passed Thursday would have allowed lawmakers to intervene and halt eminent domain proceedings. That language was later removed.
And now from the Metro in Iowa section, Liz Cheney warns of dangers if Trump win. This is by Byung Byung. Former Republican U.S. Representative Liz Cheney, a vocal critic of former President Donald Trump, said the Republican Party is currently threatening democracy and that the nation is undergoing a political shift. She made her remarks during a speech at Drake University's Knapp Center on Wednesday. The lecture, part of Drake's Buxbaum lecture series, was moderated by Lee Ann Colapiopo, the executive editor of the Denver Post. Colapiopo is a Drake graduate and previously worked in the Des Moines Register. And David might correct me on that pronunciation. Cheney said that the county's politics are undergoing a tectonic shift, citing instances of members of the Republican Party supporting Trump's claims of the election having been stolen as key evidence. "Certainly what's happening in the Republican Party is dangerous," Cheney said. "We now have one of our two major political parties that has abandoned the Constitution." Cheney, who advocates for the defeat of Trump in the polls in November, said that she hopes one of the outcomes of the political shift will be a reevaluation of how Americans engage with politics. We all have a responsibility to encourage our public officials to engage in substantive debate and to be respectful, Cheney said. I hope we will walk back from the edge of the abyss that we're looking into that has become so divisive and partisan and so toxic in so many ways. Cheney said although Trump saw sweeping success across the nation in the Republican primaries, he should not feel so confident going into the general election. In a number of these primaries, what we saw was that in some instances, close to 30% of the Republicans said that they won't vote for Donald Trump. So although he won, that is not a basis on which someone should go into a general election feeling any comfort about being able to prevail in the general, says Cheney. She also said the future of America's democracy hinges on Trump's defeat in November. We know Trump tried once not to leave office, and he will have to no incentive to guarantee a peaceful transfer of power and to leave office should he be elected again. Cheney. As frustrated as I know people get sometimes with policy disagreements that you might have, and I certainly have policy disagreements with the Biden administration, I know that the nation can survive bad policy, but we can't survive a president who is willing to torch the Constitution. Cheney said Trump is being supported by Republican officials who continue to excuse and enable his actions on January 6, adding that their continued support of Trump creates a degree of legitimacy amongst voters. Quote, Republican elected officials excuse the behavior, enabled the behavior, and by doing that, it created a situation where voters thought, well, you know, it must not be that he's that dangerous, because if he were, then you would have more people saying so, Cheney said. Cheney said the continued support of Trump prevents the party from presenting candidates who are popular among constituents.
And this story across the bottom of the Metro and Iowa section in today's Des Moines Register, headline, House lawmakers examine if $2 million in Davenport payouts flouted Iowa's open meetings law. This story by Stephen Gruber Miller. Iowa House lawmakers are digging into nearly $2 million in payments to former employees of the city of Davenport that may have been improperly approved in violation of the state's open meetings law. The Iowa House Government Oversight Committee met Wednesday for the first time this year to hear testimony from several Iowans involved in lawsuits over the settlements and public records disputes with Davenport. Last fall, Davenport City officials approved a $1.6 million settlement agreement with the former city administrator, Corey Spiegel. It included $600,000 for lost wages and $1 million for emotional pain and suffering. The council cited harassment Spiegel had received in her role with the city, including from a former city alderman, the Quad City Times reported. Two other city employees also received settlements last year, one for $157,000 and the other for $140,000. The agreements initially were approved behind closed doors, and the council met months later after the contested November city elections to approve the settlement agreements in open session. Randy Evans, executive director of the Iowa Freedom of Information Council, told lawmakers this week that Davenport's actions represent, quote, a blatant disregard for the state's public meetings laws. Evans said, It should trouble every taxpaying citizen of Iowa and members of this General Assembly that the City Council and top administrators in Davenport worked out details to pay nearly $2 million in taxpayer money to three high-ranking city employees prior to the city election last November, and yet never bothered to bring those settlements before the City Council for a public vote as required by Davenport's own city code. Alan Dirks, a chiropractor from Davenport, is suing that city over the settlements, arguing that they were enacted illegally and should be considered void. Dirks' attorney, Mike Malloy, told lawmakers this week, "Something doesn't smell right here, ladies and gentlemen. Why is the city fighting so hard to keep these matters from the public eye? The public needs and wants answers as to how these large public expenditures were spent on three city employees." Davenport is also in court over a resident's records request seeking documents related to the settlements. The request was filed by retired University of Iowa computer science professor David Ezra Sidran. That request includes a letter that the former city administrator Spiegel sent to Davenport's former city attorney, the mayor, and the city council members on September 15th that allegedly laid out instances of discrimination, harassment, bias, intimidation, and retaliation, and allegedly demanded payment from the city. After Sidran requested the document, Davenport filed a lawsuit naming him as a defendant that seeks a judgment from a district court judge about whether the document is a public record that the city must release or a confidential personnel record that it must withhold. Sidran told Iowa lawmakers on Wednesday, "I just had the audacity to legally request a document, and I was sued by the city where I live. I'm in good company, however, because the next day the city of Davenport sued the state auditor to quash his subpoena for the exact same document." Officials with the city of Davenport declined to comment on the hearing when contacted by the Des Moines Register, but they pointed to a February 16th news release from the city about Sidran's case. The news release says the city is seeking information from the court about whether the records requested by Sidran should be considered public records, and then filed a lawsuit against him only because he has requested copies of the records in question. Quote, "Any suggestion that the filing of the declaratory judgment action and naming Dr. Sidran as a defendant is an attempt to intimidate Dr. Sidran or discourage open records requests is incorrect," that news release says. It goes on to say, "The city will continue to process all open records requests as required by law." State Auditor Rob Sand said his office has opened an audit on the settlements to the former Davenport employees, saying he believes there are substantial unanswered questions about the process the city followed to approve the settlements. When the auditor's office issued a subpoena for documents related to the settlement, Sand said the city filed a court motion to block his access to the documents. Rob Sand said, "Look, it might be convenient to do things in closed session, but that's not how we should be determining how to spend taxpayer dollars. And certainly, we have very real questions as to whether or not proper procedures and the law were followed in that determination of putting that money into those settlements." What will Iowa lawmakers do next? Representative Brooke Bowden, a Republican from Indianola who chairs the Government Oversight Committee, said lawmakers are gathering information about the situation in Davenport and may hold more hearings in the future. She said if she does call representatives of the city, she wants to make sure that they would be able to answer questions rather than citing the ongoing lawsuits as a reason not to answer. Bowden said, "We absolutely have to be transparent to our citizens. We have to be respectful of taxpayer dollars, and I will be watching and paying close attention to those court cases." House lawmakers passed a bill, House File 2539, on February 22nd that raises the penalties for violating the state's open meetings law and requires elected and appointed government officials to undergo training on the open meetings law after taking office. The Senate, though, has yet to take up that legislation. Representative Lindsey James, a Democrat from Dubuque, said she'd like to see a broader conversation about transparency across state government, citing settlement agreements approved for state employees in recent years. James said, I think that this is an incredibly important conversation to be having on a state level, not just for transparency in this Davenport situation, but for our own transparency here on the state level.
Kinship Brewing lists building and land for sale. Philip Jones. Though the owner of Kinship Brewing told the Des Moines Register in November that he had no plans to sell the foreclosed business in Waukee, a commercial real estate firm is now listing the building and land for sale. Lincoln Savings Bank foreclosed on the Kinship's Waukee Tap Room at 255 Sunrise Drive Northwest in October, saying the brewery and the limited liability company that owns the property, Sunrise Drive Acquisitions, had defaulted on loans of $3.5 million and $2.4 million, and that the Kinship had failed to keep up payments on an operating loan with the $44,998 balance. Owner Zach Dobick insisted on an interview the following month that there was a path forward for the brewery, which opened in 2021, and at the time he still was opening the tap room with attenuated hours. And in December, however, amid complaints by employees that they hadn't been paid, Kinship closed the tap room, posting on Facebook that it would reopen May 1st. Court records show that on March 21, Kinship, Sunrise Drive Acquisitions, Lincoln Savings Bank, and Dobick told a Dallas County judge that they had agreed to a settlement in the foreclosure case, but needed until April 4 to finalize the terms. At first reported by the Des Moines Business Record, the property is now on the market. Riley Hogan, a senior vice president at West Des Moines Commercial Real Estate firm CBRE, said Wednesday that he is marketing the property on behalf of Kinship's investors. Dobick said did not respond to a request for comment. The listing says that the 12,180 square foot building sits on 5.95 acres with a 156 space parking lot. There is a half-acre dog park and a large patio and a beer production facility with $1.5 million in equipment and a $40,000 barrel annual capacity. In addition, Kinship, for a period in 2023, also was hosting a fine dining restaurant. Hogan said several breweries, both in Iowa and elsewhere, have inquired about the facility. Likely its best use would be as a brewery because it is ready to start making beer immediately, he said. In fact, Kinship Brews continue to be on draft at some local bars as recently as last month. But Hogan said the building also could lend itself to other uses, such as a bowling alley with a restaurant, and he said there is enough room on the site for a separate retail on office building. For an office building. So we could have a business owner buy the building and build their office building right there, Hogan said. Build an apartment building there or build condo units. There's so many opportunities out there that present themselves that are different in today's world than it was 5 years ago. This building plays right into those expanding categories. The sales listing does not specify an asking price, and Hogan said that it is negotiable. The Dallas County property appraiser lists the building asset assessed value at $2.4 million, but Dobick in November said a private appraiser had valued it at $5.3 million. Dobick in 2020 said that he had moved to the Des Moines Metro with his wife, an Iowa native, from Atlanta in 2018, with opening a brewery in mind. Areas surrounding Kinship have boomed since Kinship opened. Waukee is among the fastest growing cities in Iowa, and single-family and multifamily housing developments are being built along the Raccoon River Valley Trail, which is connected to property. and Waukee Northwest High School sits about a half mile away. Hogan described the project as slightly ahead of its time and said that with the infrastructure work that has gone into the area since Kinship opened, it is primed for another owner to turn it into an asset for Waukee. The landscape out there has changed so much over the last 12 months, Hogan said. The residential rooftop growth is feeding a bunch of demand for new retail, so I think we're in a good position.
Sand. A.G. Byrd is playing politics over Plan B payments. The pause has been in effect during entirety of review. This story by Michaela Rahm. State Auditor Rob Sand is accusing Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd of playing politics by freezing payments for sexual assault victims' morning after pills, saying that Byrd is hiding behind an audit to avoid accountability for her decision. Rob Sand, the sole Democrat in state office, criticized Byrd, a Republican, for pausing those payments while her office conducts a review of victim services, which has been ongoing since she took office more than a year ago. In particular, Sand took issue with use of the term audit during his news conference on Wednesday. He told reporters at the Capitol, the Attorney General's choice of the word on this helps her avoid accountability for her decision on day one in office to quit paying for emergency contraception for sexual assault survivors. Under former Attorney General Tom Miller, who was defeated by Byrd while seeking his 11th term in office, the state had covered the cost of emergency contraceptives and, in rare cases, abortions for sexual assault victims through the state's Victim Compensation Fund. The fund uses fines and penalties paid by individuals convicted of crimes and does not use any general taxpayer dollars. Byrd, a staunch abortion opponent, paused those payments while her office conducted a, quote, top-down, bottom-up audit of victim assistance to evaluate whether the policy is an appropriate use of public funds. That's according to Byrd's communications director, Alyssa Brulé. Brulé said in a statement on Wednesday, the state auditor and Planned Parenthood are flat wrong. It's a shame that the auditor is playing politics with a critical audit of victim services and blasting misinformation to boost his own profile. We will publicly release the report once it is final. The Attorney General's office confirmed to the Register last week that it has submitted a draft of its victim services review and the report is in its, quote, final stages. However, officials declined to provide the draft as part of the Register's submitted public records request. Brulé wouldn't elaborate on Wednesday on the draft report, saying instead that officials are still compiling materials and that the office will release the report to the public when it's complete. She said in an email to the Register, we are in the final stages of the audit and will be publicly releasing the report as soon as it's final. Byrd has remained firm in her decision to pause those payments while her office conducts the so-called audit, even as victim services advocates have expressed concern on the potential impact on victims. Sand said the trauma and the pain the Attorney General's decision is putting victims through in this case literally makes my skin crawl. Planned Parenthood advocates of Iowa denounced the move in a recent statement, calling it deplorable. The Attorney General's office use of the term audit has led to questions on whether the state auditor's office is involved, Sand said. He said Byrd has never asked his office to audit payments for sexual assault victims' emergency contraceptions, and he said there is no other party involved. Rob Sand said an internal review is a more accurate characterization for the Attorney General's inquiry. Sand said governments, school districts, or other agencies undergoing an audit typically do not pause funding or otherwise stop ongoing operations during their annual audits. And given the small amount of funding used to cover the cost for morning after pills, he said there's not a high risk for fraud or misspent funds within that program. He said, there's been no suggestion whatsoever that there was anything inappropriate going on in the decades that Attorney General Tom Miller was providing reimbursements for sexual assault survivors' use of emergency contraceptives. Sand added, at this point to me, it's abundantly clear that whatever's going on over there is politics.
Court finds suspect in Iowa meat plant murder still incompetent, William Morris. A man charged with stabbing a co-worker to death 3 years ago will remain in treatment after the Iowa Court of Appeals found him still incompetent to stand trial. Lucas Brown, now 29, was charged with first-degree murder in the death of 50-year-old Wayne Smith in February of 21. The two worked together at the Prestige Foods pork processing plant in Eagle Grove. Brown stabbed Smith in the throat in an employee locker room. Brown's case was swiftly put on hold after evaluators found that he was not competent to stand trial, and he was sent to receive treatment. In January 22, the doctors with the Iowa Department of Corrections reported that they believed Brown could not be restored to competency due to his schizophrenia and other conditions, a finding that would trigger civil commitment procedures. The prosecutors got a second opinion, though, and the trial court ruled in June of 22 that Brown now was competent for trial. More than 2 years later, the appeals court has reversed that ruling and sent Brown back for yet more treatment. The judges found the DOC expects better qualified experts, better qualified. Their reports were thorough and noted that even the prosecution's expert found that Brown struggled to understand the charges and the workings of the legal system. In one instance, the judge noted, Brown suggested to the examiner that the jury might function like court jesters for a trial. Despite this, the appeals court ruled that there were signs that Brown might be improving and directed the trial court to order further treatment in hopes that he might eventually be able to stand trial. Judge Gina Batting wrote the opinion, which was joined by Mary Taper. A third judge, Tyler Buller, wrote that he agreed with the outcome but voiced concern over the applicable standard. Under Iowa precedent, appellate courts handling competency cases are to review the record and reach their own conclusions about the defendant's fitness for trial, while in all other states, courts give greater deference to the trial judge and only overturn for extreme errors. And under Iowa standard, Buller wrote, Wednesday's decision is correct, but he suggested the Iowa Supreme Court may wish to revisit that standard to bring Iowa in line with other states.
And moving to some national news now, the Republican National Committee is asking job applicants if the 2020 election was stolen. This story by David Jackson of the USA Today, Dateline Washington. As Donald Trump has tightened his grip on the Republican National Committee in recent months, the organization has asked job applicants if they believe the 2020 election was stolen, raising questions about whether the false belief is a qualification for party employment. The former president himself constantly claims, without any proof, that President Joe Biden and allies rigged the 2020 election. Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee in 2024, has made it clear for years he expects aides, allies, and voters to agree with him, often publicly criticizing individuals who correctly point out that there was not widespread voter fraud in the race. The Washington Post, which first reported the interview questions at the RNC, quoted unidentified applicants as saying they were uncomfortable answering the open-ended inquiries about alleged election theft. One of them told the Post, "If you say the election wasn't stolen, do you really think you're going to get hired?" RNC and Trump campaign officials have told USA Today that election integrity is one of their top priorities and that applicants are being asked a variety of questions about the process. A statement from Danielle Alvarez, a spokesperson for the Republican National Committee and the Trump campaign, said potential staffers who worked on the front line in battleground states or are currently in states where fraud allegations have been prevalent were asked about their work experience. We want experienced staff with meaningful views on how elections are won and lost and real experience-based opinions about what happens in the trenches, Alvarez said. However, Democrats and other Trump opponents said the former president wants the RNC and other supporters to spread the big lie, a term used to refer to false claims about the 2020 election that all led to the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th of 2021. Spokesperson for the Biden-Harris campaign, Amar Moussa, said, "In Donald Trump's America, elections are only fair when he wins, and nothing's off the table to stay in power, including violence like on January 6th, and being a dictator on day one." Moussa accused Trump of demanding fealty to his extreme. He also alleged that the former president wants anti-democratic beliefs to be part of his Republican Party, including attacks on democracy or calls for violence. After the 2020 election, Trump's efforts to overturn his election loss led to criminal indictments in two jurisdictions, Washington and the state of Georgia. As Trump swiftly locked down the GOP nomination earlier this year, he engineered a change of leadership at the RNC, including appointing his daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, as party co-chair. Michael Whatley, the other co-chair, also received Trump's support in recent months. Whatley, a close Trump ally, previously chaired the North Carolina Republican Party. During their first week on the job, the new RNC leadership team laid off dozens of employees, although some of them are reapplying for their jobs.